and welcome back to the Healthcare Executive Insights Podcast. My name is Elliot Sloan with the McCallum Group. We're very excited to introduce today's guest, Mr. Mike Boblitz, who's the CEO at TOC. Mike, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today.
Elliot, my pleasure. Looking forward to talking to you.
Likewise. So let's start with an introduction and tell us a little bit about your professional background, and then we'll learn more about TOC.
Sure. I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, born in Philadelphia, but age 6 months. My parents, I think, realized that they wanted me to be closer to home. My dad's a son of a policeman from Baltimore, Maryland, and so he was lobbying to go there. My mom is a farmer's daughter from Madison County, Virginia, just north of Charlottesville, Virginia, and of course she wanted to go there. And I always tell people that, like in any marriage, the wife won that one. So I was raised in Charlottesville from age 6 months all the way through. My dad is the one and only chief administrator for orthopedic surgery and sports at University of Virginia, 45 years in the making. So I grew up on the sidelines of UVA athletics, and I had a dream to be a doctor one day. But long story short, one day and years later, I was under the mentorship of a very well-known sports medicine physician who's now deceased, named Dr. Frank McHugh. He kind of wrote the book on sports and had me a shadow in the OR one day, and I passed out. And quickly knew that that probably wasn't my cup of tea. And so I switched my career from health sciences, sports medicine, to health sciences, health administration undergrad at James Madison University, and kind of never looked back. And, you know, got out and was blessed to go back to my hometown in Charlottesville, working in finance at University of Virginia on that physician practice side of the equation. And I wanted to do more. And because my dad and I had the same name, and I was getting all his emails, and to this day, they call me Little Life at UVA, but I'm not that little anymore. I kind of knew I needed to go do my own thing. And so I kind of then, back then, you had jobs in the newspaper, and I found this senior planning analyst job at the other hospital in Charlottesville called Martha Jefferson. And just kind of once I got in, and I think it was week number two, the CEO was invited me into a boardroom, which at UVA, being a billion-dollar enterprise, I didn't have the opportunity to be that close to the executive team. And the CEO was, I'll never forget, was sitting at the head of the table and putting his hand down and kind of talking about how he was so upset that the city continued to deny their request for rezoning. They were kind of a city block in downtown Charlottesville, and they couldn't expand anymore. And he said, yeah, we've got to build a case to move the hospital, which was then kind of thinking, what do we do? How do we get there over the next 10 years? And what does it take? And so went from finance, which kind of looks backwards, to more strategy, which looks forward far to the future and how you evolve your organization and stay relevant in the marketplace. And so I just got hooked on strategy. Started publishing papers at the time, and started to kind of go up, and got a call to work eventually at Johns Hopkins and in their strategy office, and a new position to help with considering strategic partners. Learned a ton there, and went on eventually and got a crash course in building an ambulatory network at a place called Lancaster General Health in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But really wanted to be a chief strategy officer somewhere. I was getting calls from a lot of places, a lot of cities, but like my mom, my wife has a big say in where we go. And so we ultimately found an opportunity to go work in Gwinnett County and North Atlanta market. And I served as the head of strategy for their health system for a long time. That was kind of my career. But ultimately, like in a lot of hospitals everywhere I've worked, we've always done mergers, and either at Hopkins, others joined us, or at Gwinnett, we kind of needed to find a bigger capital partner, and was blessed to kind of merge Gwinnett with the bigger system there in Atlanta called Northside. And I wanted to do something different, and wanted to, in the hospital world, respond to the market forces that were making it challenging for hospitals to be relevant. And I was, my vision was for hospitals to build an ambulatory network outside of hospital-based pricing to respond to the purchasers of the world and employers' desires to provide a lower cost with the same quality. But I ultimately found this opportunity to serve as CEO at Tallahassee Orthopedic Clinic. And yeah, we're blessed, and we have 50 years of tradition, and we have our own surgery centers, and we have our own MRIs and our own physical therapy. It's basically in regards to musculoskeletal, we have the complete ecosystem to really, I think, align nicely with the purchasers' desires to bend the cost curve. And so we're just getting started. But we have, in my opinion, we've been around 50 years, but I think we're just getting started for the next 50 years and just doing some great things that I can be happy to share with you.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing your lengthy history as a chief strategy officer. It sounds like you've really seen a lot, from large systems to medium systems, and you've learned as you went that the hospital model is not future-proof. And it sounds like that's what led you into private practice.
Very much so. And I always say, you know, it's in strategy, it's every market's different. There's not a one size fits all. And so I really kind of focus on local market forces and competitive forces and build a strategy that's reflective of that. And so, but yeah, I think TOC and where we are now, and we're blasting. We are started to really focus on services that once upon a time were in the hospital. I remember when I first came to TOC, most of our joint replacement cases were hospital based. And so today we think over the past year and a half, we've seen about a 350% shift into our surgery center. We've invested in the Mako robot and Versa robot, which if you understand orthopedics, the robotic platform is important for surgeons.
Oh, yeah.
And we had to build out that platform, which are pretty big investments. I won't get into prices, but we'll just say seven figures collectively in investment. But we did that because we understand in order for us to really play a role and then in the cost curve, we have to create or replicate the traditional hospital environment in a lower cost surgical center environment. And the robotic platform is a piece of that. And so we're really focusing on that pretty hard. And we're about to break ground on a boutique spot and joint replacement surgical center of excellence to let us take it to the next level. And level insurance commissioners who I can't name on this call, but I've all said, please do that immediately. That'll really help us further accelerate cost reduction, and the employer community is only going to benefit. So, and as you know, the best part is the patient wins, because the hospital is a great place. But if you think about having an elective surgical case, you go into this massive garage, you're early in the morning, you walk in and you see thousands of people, you already have anxiety because you're not sure how your surgical case is going to go. You think it's going to go good. And you go through this gigantic maze, and then you find that your case has been bumped for 2 hours because they just had a trauma case come in, and you have to sit and wait. And so in our model, you don't wait. Our scheduled patients are our scheduled patients. And we, for a joint replacement, we get you down in a matter of hours. You go into the hospital environment, you stay for overnight perhaps. So we're very pleased and really focusing on the patient and helping the patient, you know, get great access and get them moved fast and, you know, with great care.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, we now live in a world where people expect their healthcare to be white glove, and they expect their healthcare to be convenient and almost come to them versus them have to go find healthcare. Talk to me about how you transitioned the practice from such a heavy relationship on cases at a hospital to rolling out a very ASC dominant model.
So really, it's just paying attention to if you watch the market forces. In Atlanta, it started with Anthem with the national policy to no longer cover what they call elective patients visiting emergency departments, and so that fueled, and I took advantage of that in North Atlanta, the urgent care environment. Right, that was that the urgent care model took off pretty quick, and then shortly behind that, and then other payers kind of followed. But then shortly behind that, the similar national policies came out about no longer covering elective MRI or CT scans in hospital-based environments. And if you go, you're going to pay full freight as a beneficiary, or you can go to a freestanding center across the street at an affordable price point. And so all that data is there. And then more recently, you're starting to see more and more in different markets, large insurance companies started kind of have that same model and policy change around elective outpatient surgery.
Sure.
And so the data only suggests that's one day we're going to wake up and payer policy going to say for us in orthopedics, if you don't have all of your patients that are elective in a surgical center environment, then you're no longer relevant in the market, right? So I'm really responding and kind of getting ahead of those trends, because when that day comes, and I think it will come, we have the foundation built, which is, again, while we're investing in another boutique spot and joint replacement surgical center. So we have enough runway to we can make a difference. We're trying to build our infrastructure as we speak to prepare ourselves for kind of the future of medicine.
Yeah. And for our audience who isn't familiar with TOC yet, tell us how big your footprint is and how many patients you're treating.
Sure. So TOC was founded about 50 years ago and by two physicians named Doug Henderson and Dr. Tom Haney, and sports medicine trained, and they saw kind of, we call it the Big Bend in Northwest Florida as kind of a gap in care. And obviously they're sports focused. And so there are a lot of high schools, mostly rural around this area, and also Florida State University, and just really not a big healthcare ecosystem. And so they were very wise to hang a shingle, because today the organizations ran from those two founding physicians. And now we have 35 physicians and other north of 40 APPs, which in orthopedics, we rank first in the country for private practice orthopedics and the use of APP per FTE doctor. And wow. So we've grown a lot. And today we service about 250,000 patients. We have, through our strategy, we've grown from a greater Tallahassee market where we have three business units. We have a South Georgia business unit. We have our legacy Tallahassee business unit. Now we have a new division in Panama City. So there's three business units run basically independent of one another to allow us to focus on really building the brand and providing local services and scaling what we've already built in Tallahassee, but to where each market over time has their own surgery center, has their own MRIs, has their own physical therapy, has all the subspecialties of orthopedics. We're always saying in the business community, you know, orthopedics is not orthopedics. We're actually buying companies. You know, we're a spine company, we're a hand company, we're a joint company, we're a pediatric company, a trauma company, et cetera. And so really we need to build these three markets where, like we have this in Tallahassee, but each of the other markets in South Georgia, Panama City, we need to evolve in the same model. And because we know we've been extremely successful in the past 50 years in Tallahassee, we know for sure that by replicating and scaling our model in these new territories, South Georgia, Panama City, will continue to go on a good run. And so with 250,000 patients and patients choosing to travel from hours away to bypass local general orthopedists to come to Tallahassee and to see our physicians, we know we're blessed to really have a great solution and just working really hard because we do cover a lot of geography. We work really hard and we have a lot of regional offices and we're adding more regional offices every day just to try to have the greatest reach and impact to make healthcare better.
Yeah, that's very exciting. It sounds like you guys are growing at record rates. Tell me about how different it is in those three markets. You know, how much was a learning experience where you're like, well, this isn't actually working the same as it was in Tallahassee?
That's a very good question. So we have realized every day that South Georgia is not Tallahassee, Panama City is not Tallahassee. And so we have a core foundation, right, of our central administrative services, or our administrative platform that is scalable. And really any market, basically, it doesn't matter, right? You can extend it. But regards to local service, for example, the needs in Panama City for what specialty of orthopedics is the top priority is different than South Georgia. So we really study the market first and let the market dictate a strategy and our agenda. Wherever time we want to have all of the above, but as you know, you can't just do all everything at once. And so we're really trying to focus on local market needs and let those market needs drive kind of the agenda. And so far, off to a great start. Panama City is just a new thing for us. We started that in September of this past year. We're growing like crazy. So we started off with one fellowship-trained sports medicine position. And we, on April 1st, here in a couple of weeks, we'll add our second pain management position. And then in July 1st, we'll add an adult reconstructive joint replacement position. And we have more behind. And so again, the idea is that, so you got sports, you got joints, you got pain, but let's keep building it out. But those are the specialties that the local market suggested that we really needed to focus on at first, and doing the same thing up in South Georgia. So kind of the same model. So,
sure. That makes a lot of sense. You got to let the data tell the story.
That's correct. Yeah. I grew up that my first job way back when was in the financial analyst. And so I was, and I also am on faculty at Florida State College of Business, where I teach their first ever course in healthcare management. And I always describe, you know, healthcare strategy as a pyramid. And before you can really do anything, the base of that pyramid is what I call strategic and business analytics. You have to know your market better than anybody to create a competitive advantage. You have to know your business better than ever before to help identify and leverage opportunities. And if you do that foundation really well, and then this is kind of my strategy hat, then you kind of install a very disciplined business planning and strategy program on top, which will allow you to test and evaluate ideas and data. And if you do that really well, you'll start to get business plans approved. And as they're approved, then you go to execution, which is the top of that pyramid. And so it's a very simple way to look at it, but that's kind of how I've kind of focused on strategy and deployment, and it's been successful. And again, we're doing some great things here.
It's a bottom-up approach versus a top-down.
Very much so. And that's been my philosophy. Really, I'm glad you mentioned that. For my career, when I came up in my career back in 2000, when I got an undergrad, it was very much a top-down environment. And being someone who was at the bottom, I never really appreciated or really enjoyed that, having someone always looking over your shoulder. And so I'm a big believer in creativity and autonomy. And to really try to create an environment where all your workforce could be successful, right? And then create trust.
Sure.
So I've always kind of flipped the switch, if you will, when I got my first director job way back when, to go from a top-down view to a bottom-up. And even to my job to this day, I always say I've gotten blessed to have a great management team. And I serve at the pleasure of our board, but also I serve at the pleasure of a management team. And my job is not to tell them what to do, but kind of get us on the same page for vision and strategy. And then basically serve as a solution to them. If they have roadblocks or barriers, I help take those things away so they can kind of be successful and stay on point with their particular agendas and work plans for the year.
Yeah, and I'm sure that managerial team appreciates you getting your hands dirty.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't know if I'm going to call it getting your hands dirty, but creating, I paved the road for our team. And then they basically take it from there. And all I do is basically ask for an update to make sure that, hey, kind of like if you're going with your dad on a long trip across country, your dad's driving, you kind of fall asleep for a little bit, and you wake up and, hey, are we all still on course? And so that's kind of my job, is make sure we're still on course. And if not, if we have any issues, to kind of I kind of help with my level of authority to help kind of address those things. And I think that's the right management style. And I think, again, it creates, allows us to engage our workforce to work at the highest level. And again, you know, it's a two-way street, because I always talk about accountability is big. And so accountability is a huge problem in healthcare. Even when I first came to Tallahassee, same thing here. And so we really focused hard on culture. And so values is something that's so important to me. And you go into pick the top 100 orthopedic companies in America and sit out front of their parking lot at 8 o'clock on a Monday and just survey all their workers going in if they can replicate or repeat what their values are. And you'll probably get maybe 10% of the workforce and get all, usually about five values, could be like trustworthy, respect, dignity, all those things. But no one really appreciates it. It's never really connected to the frontline worker. And accountability is usually never there, right? So when I came to really kind of get their frontline worker and our entire workforce behind our strategy and their agenda, I kind of had to think about, what's the right values for us? And so I kind of started to realize one day at home that it's really our people that power our company.
Sure.
And that's power. Power are our values. Power, for we want you to kind of work into a passion. Going back to accountability, O stands for ownership. We want you to have ownership, because I want you to have freedom to be successful. But you have to be accountable. You have to own that.
Sure.
If you fail, you need to accept failure. And we need to work with you to kind of right the ship. And you know, W stands for we, not I, because we're just not an individual agenda. This is, you know, an organization, and we work as one, as a family. And E is for excellence, because there's always other organizations out there that want to compete with us. And R is for, at first I thought I was going to go with results. But then I kind of sat back, reflected, and said, well, if we're asking your workforce to do so much for us and work so hard, shouldn't it be more recognition? And the least we can do, if I've got a someone sitting at the front desk making minimum wage, working hard on patient experience, least I can do is recognize the great work. And so power is kind of our kind of values that I've rolled out here. And it's been tremendously successful, and our culture is kind of at an all-time high. And we have great engagement with everybody across the company. So,
yeah, and I love that. And I just wrote that down. It's a powerful acronym. And you're 100% right. You know, the intake team is really the first line of defense with the patient experience. They're going to dictate right off the bat how this person feels from that first moment moving on, dealing with the practice.
No, it's so true. And you know, patients have anxiety, and sometimes you have bottlenecks in the system, which we always work every day to minimize those bottlenecks. I think are one of the best now at access and keeping patients moving through the system. But where I spend most of my time, and sometimes I feel like it makes others unhappy, but I spend most of my time not with the doctors in their clinics, not with their PAs. I spend most of my time going around and rounding with the front desk teams.
Yep.
Because I believe very much that they're the first encounter, so to speak. And they also are kind of the front line where they take a lot of shots. Patients get upset, they can get unhappy, and sometimes really for no reason, just they had a bad day going into the office. And so the frontline worker and the front desk worker has to deal with that. And so,
yep.
So I'm always really focused on taking a pulse and always asking them, is there anything that we could do better to improve the experience of our patients and for the efficiencies of our operations? So it helps me a lot. I think they appreciate it. And so it's a big deal.
Yeah. And that's probably what separates you from the pack. Not many CEOs of an organization your size are spending so much time with the front front desk staff.
Yeah, I think it matters, you know. I think that's something that, and I reflect for when I started as an analyst way back when, I had a chief operating officer who took me under his wing. And so I've always felt like kind of giving it back. And it makes a difference. You spend a little time with everybody, they appreciate it, and they work harder.
Sure.
You know? So if they work harder, then our company's more successful.
Let me ask you about your growth strategies. You know, when you're going into new markets, when you're identifying there is a gap in your access to care, you need a new office in a new location, you need additional providers. Are you looking to acquire groups that are already strong, have a strong presence in those markets and educate them on the value of joining the TOC brand? Or are you typically opening an office and recruiting young talent at a residency programs?
I always say it's not a one size fits all, right? And so we have five strategic pillars in our strategic plan that I call Vision 2030 that runs through 2030. First is patient experience. We've already talked about that. And I made that first intentionally. I think that's important. Second is improving quality and cost of care. And that goes back to our surgical center developments and moving patients in lower cost environments. Third is strategic growth, right? Fourth is going to where you just mentioned a minute ago, scale and strategic partnerships. And fifth is financial viability, because I always have to make my CFO happy because we have to have a good financial model. And I'm always looking at strategic partnerships, north, south, east, and west. We're blessed because we have a great administrative platform that smaller groups do not have and we can solve for. So I'm actually engaged with several groups as we speak to consider joining us. But as I always say to them, they run their market, but together, you know, we're a stronger organization. But then in Panama City, we realized that market had a lot of gaps and a lot of shortages of physicians. And so you really couldn't, there really was no one there to offer to try to bring in. So we had to build that from scratch. In our South Georgia market, we found two very seasoned orthopedic physicians that were at a private practice, but just not adequately equipped to be relevant for the long term. And they realized that. And so we were blessed to have them join us, right?
Sure.
So it's kind of never a one size fits all. And then all the time we're recruiting, like here in Tallahassee, we have a couple of new fellows that have just joined us that have a bright career and off to a great start. So you kind of depends on the situation. Yeah, it's a good mix. It's kind of like I always say, it's like what they think. It's like your 401k. You want to kind of have a diversification of funds and that kind of minimizes risk and maximizes your returns.
So when you say you have a good administrative platform, is this an MSO?
I think we function very much like an MSO. We have, when I came, we had some things like appointment scheduling and referral authorizations and workers' comp authorizations and all of these different regional offices. And so we've now centralized all those things, and which has allowed us to have not as many needs for duplicating resources and cost at these regional offices, and allow them to really focus on what's most important to patient experience. And So with that, we have one of the largest revenue cycle teams for private practice orthopedics in the country. We have about a 40-person revenue cycle team now that's working harder and harder every day, which is tricky with the administrative challenges. But unfortunately, every insurance company has different rules, and so you have to stay current on kind of what their rules and expectations are, so you have kind of a quick cash flow to your revenue cycle. And so we've got a great supply chain kind of team. And I think we're very much like an MSO, but more of an in-house, you know, private practice perspective. And
it
allows us to, again, as when we went to Panama City, we didn't hire more referral authorization people. We didn't hire more appointment schedule. We didn't have to do all that because we had it centralized. And so we set up at fractions of resources instead of at whole resources, and allows us to kind of run as we grow at a improve our financial performance.
Yeah, you have a playbook, a turnkey system.
Right. Very true.
So we know from this brief conversation, you guys are really building something unique. You're scaling, you're creating a lot of value, and it's mostly the patients that are benefiting the most, right? They're better access to care. They're better experience at the ASCs. They're lower cost of care. But there's got to be some issues that come with the growth and challenges that come with the growth. Not specifically talking about TOC specifically on this question, but what do you think are the most pressing issues and challenges private practices are facing in 2023 and going into the future?
I think that's a great question. So I'll reference an inflation. I just added to the inflation report that came out this morning, but that was coming when as I was rushing off to work. Like you remember, in the height of this past year, inflation was what, an all time high of, I think it was up to like about 8%, right? It was a big problem. But you look under the hood, in inflation for private medical groups, 1%. 1%, no change. It's actually a little better than it was. Why is that? Well, Medicare every year, when Medicare for hospitals does a 3% or so, market adjustment, right, for hospitals, which are high cost and killing the employer community and by default killing the private commercial payers. So you have that out there. But then Medicare for medical groups for years, and you see all the reports every year, they threaten 5% cut and then turns out to be 2.4% or whatever it was this year, right? So I think one of the challenges that everybody faces is the reimbursement model is broken. On one side, and the employer community, rightfully so, is driving it, because that's the economic engine of America, right? It's enough. We can no longer tolerate these rising, spiraling costs of care, right? So how do you fix that? Do you continue to give hospitals, which are really nothing more than a stage for positions to work from, continue to give them increases and then reduce fees for doctors who are the ones who really have the ability to expand and focus and provide more resources to keep patients out of the costly hospital to begin with, right? So I think the reimbursement model is broken. And then on the commercial side, same thing. Most hospitals have what they call inflation adjustments into their hospital contracts, where every year they get more. I would say 90% of private medical groups, if not more across the country, have no inflation built into their contracts with like Blue Cross Blue Shield, et cetera. So the costs are going up. Medicare's paying less, and the private insurance companies are actually giving no inflation to private medical groups. And so, how do you manage that? Luckily, we're large enough to where we can continue to grow and add revenue, right? But most of the private groups in America can't, and so they're struggling. And so they can't expand. If you can't expand, then you can't solve the problem, which is focusing on access to keep patients out of the hospital.
Sure. And you have to get creative to stay alive, right? If your costs are going up and your reimbursements are stagnant or going down, the only other option is ancillary services, cash paying services. I see it all the time. Groups just running in circles, chasing their tail, trying to figure out what else they could bring in house that they really have no desire to bring in, but they need something.
That's very true. And then obviously, you always say, and a CFO many moons ago taught me, always have this word, cash is king. And so that's why we have a 40-person revenue cycle team. So if you are getting paid less, the other answer is collect faster.
Sure. Right?
So we're blessed because we're large enough and our board is trustworthy enough we invested a lot more people over the past since I joined. And that's allowed our cash to be accelerated, coupled with expanding our surgery center, coupled with adding more MRIs and things like that. But that only goes so far. Eventually, the healthcare system will not be sustainable long-term unless Medicare and the private insurance community start to re-engineer themselves to say, stop giving all these additional market adjustments to costly hospitals. That's allowing that model to be sustained. Let's re-engineer ourselves and take some of those increases and reinvest in the physician community, and with the caveat that we want them to expand or reinvest in their practices. And if so, I think our healthcare system has a shot to really be do some really great things. But we're kind of getting to this tipping point. Really, for smaller groups, we're way beyond tipping points. And then what happens is these smaller groups join hospitals, and then what happens when they join hospitals? Cost goes up, right? I'm just been waiting for Medicare and the private insurance community to kind of recognize the need to kind of not feel like it's okay to not to say no to the hospital. The stronger hospitals survive, the ones that won't. But they gotta draw a line in the sand at some point, recognize that physicians are the answer.
Sure. And give them the power, right? To provide the better care and provide better access, where the hospital is a brick and mortar and there's one location and there's, only so many operating rooms and so many specialists, right? There's just a cap.
Right. Very true. And so I think that's honestly, I'm trying to think if there's anything else beyond that. But I think that's the greatest challenge that medical groups face is the status quo reimbursement model of America.
And what do you think will need to happen for them to actually start shifting these inflations revenues to private practice versus health systems?
So, unfortunately, it's grassroots, where I'm constantly talking with our local insurance commissioners, and I call them purchasers, and changing the model to say, you know, see us as not as an expense, which pretty much 99% of the insurance companies out there see providers as an expense, but see us as an investment. Invest in us to help you fulfill your obligation to your client, the employer, who's upset and frustrated with these rising costs, these rising premiums. That I get it, you as the payer, you have to extend because of the environment we're in, but come and invest in us to make a difference. That's kind of that's kind of how it gets to. And so I talk with our insurance commissioners all the time, and I share with them things that we're doing, like when I invested in the Mako robot, or more recently the Versa robot. And they said, well, why is that? And I said, well, that's because of part of our value-based care agenda. And they would say, well, what do you mean? I remember when I first got the Mako, and the CFO of this one insurance company reached out, and the CEO was there. And I said, well, we're doing that because it's our value-based agenda. And I believe, and I think you guys have the data, but I believe I just saved you 30 to 40% by creating this platform and this service in my service center. That once upon a time, that robot always is in the hospital. And the CFO leaned in and said, actually, for us, it's 41% cost savings.
Wow. I said, well,
yo.
Wow.
So not just, but it's really one conversation at a time, but I'm hoping that at a higher level, they start to understand that if we can re-engineer the model and make more of an investment in the medical community, the physician community, I think the correlation will be, you'll see emergency department visits drop. You'll see, services that can be done outside the hospital, MRIs, outpatient surgery, et cetera, you'll see a lot of that shift because you're now allowing physicians to have the financial means to invest in those resources to grow, you know, grow their practices, right? And help solve the problem. But so it's going to unfortunately be a combination of grassroots and hopefully over time legislative change and leadership change, you know, in the insurance industry to kind of want to take a chance, you know, to try something different because we're just not on the right path.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, the payers just want to satisfy investors, right? And their stakeholders. So they would want to be the ones spearheading anything that's going to bring their costs down. With this model, it drastically does.
Yeah. And I would say too, a lot of people give insurance companies a bad name. All they're doing is responding to what the employer wants, you know, and just, so, you know, the employer's upset the payer, right? Because costs keep rising. And the payer for years has tried to go to the medical community and say, please reduce your ER visits. You know, please, you know, send more patients to imaging centers. Please, but nothing happens. So the payers are frustrated. So now you're seeing payers start to build out their own provider networks, whether it be getting their own surgery centers or investing in medical groups, et cetera. So it's all that trends are already happening. But so I don't think it's really the payer is the bad person. The payer is just trying to do their best, and they've been patient responding to the employer's frustrations. And now they're frustrated. The payer's frustrated the provider, right? So all we have to do is kind of re-engineer kind of the mindset and kind of work together. But I believe that for us anyway, aligning with the purchasers and partnering with the purchasers is going to be the best way to create the answer. And again, not having the purchaser or the payer see us as an expense, but see us as an investment to allow them to respond to their employer's frustrations, right? So it's kind of a different view. So that's my takeaway anyway. I think that, you know, again, everyone finger points. I think it's just, we just have to find ways to partner together, you know?
Yeah. And it sounds like what you're kind of getting at is, the payers really want people to be more proactive with healthcare and preventative care and keeping costs down. Do you think an issue is part of, you know, a part of the big problem is there's so many fragmented systems within healthcare that Specialist A cannot communicate easily to Specialist B and C and so on, and there's no continuum of care for most patients?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a big deal, right? And again, for our model, for I'll call it musculoskeletal, we're blessed to pretty much have all the services under one roof. But if you think about traditional population health, I think that think about the primary care model, for example. I agree 100%. So they have patients that have cardiovascular disease, diabetes, you know, arthritis, right? And so to me, the answer, and now I'm going to put on my primary care hat for a second and forget about TOC, that we have to evolve the primary care model to where they have those medical subspecialties integrated within their practice, mm-hmm. or as closely integrated as possible to fix that particular issue.
100%.
You know, one of my dreams is one day to where we must have an Evolver MSO to be a full population health MSO, where we have a large primary care company, we have a large cardiology company, we have all these companies that are basically still running distinct, but have an MSO with one electronic record and platform.
Correct.
Where we can link all of that together. And I think that's ultimately the future. In the meantime, I think primary care has to keep expanding with more medical specialties and orthopedic groups or other, let's say, specialty practices that need to do what we've done, which is to create a self-enclosed ecosystem where the patient never has to leave.
Yep.
And we just have to keep making steps in the right direction.
Yeah, and kudos to you guys to really being able to create that entire ecosystem. I know there's a lot of groups out there trying to crack that nut, and it's something that very few can do from what we've seen.
Yeah, we're very blessed. You know, you have a great business model. You have a great board and physicians that are willing to make investments. And so we have that, and we're making those investments, and every day we're getting stronger.
Well, let me leave you with this. You know, I know we've covered a lot and our audience will really love tuning in. What's the next 5 years look like for TOC?
Sure. So the next 5 years for TOC is we're going to become the trusted partner of all the purchasers, the employers, the payers, even the universities, by embracing cost reduction and clinical excellence. That's kind of what we're doing and working hard to kind of partner more with these purchasers every day. So I think that's kind of going to be the future. As we do that, you'll see us kind of grow South Georgia's market a lot. You'll see us grow Pinellas City's market a lot. We'll probably have a couple more markets along the way. But really in the end, just kind of helping us kind of extend our reach to the patient, which needs us, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting that what's been so successful for you guys is fight for the patient.
Right. That's right. I think as long as everything is focused on creating value for the patient, you really can't make a bad decision.
Patients first, they say, and the rest will come.
That's right. Very true. Very true.
Hey, Mike, I want to thank you again for your time today. It's been a real pleasure. We've learned a lot. I think, you know, you guys are in a position where a lot of orthopods and multi-specialty musculoskeletal groups are hoping to get to in their five-year plan. So congratulations to you guys.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I really appreciate your time.
You have a wonderful day.
You too.
Take care.